Knights of the Crusades, casts a spell over them and then holds them for her pleasure in her pleasure palace. Oh, she's a kind of medieval Hugh Hefner, if you will. Against her will, she has fallen in love with Renaud, who has upset her royally by freeing all of her crusader captives, all of her toys. Oh, dear. In this scene, she is determined to kill Renaud while he sleeps. But, my friends, she can't do it. So, for a change, one less bosom piercing in that otherwise bosom piercing happy world of Baroque opera. We hear a stormy opening orchestral prelude which mirrors well Armide's anger and passion for Renaud. And here is what she sings in recitative. Finally, he is in my power, this fatal enemy, this superb warrior. The charm of sleep delivers him to my vengeance. I will pierce his invincible heart. Through him, all my captives have escaped from slavery. Let him feel my anger. What fear grips me? What makes me hesitate? What in his favor does pity want to tell me? Let us strike! Heavens, who can stop me? Let us get on with it. But I tremble. Let us avenge. I sigh. It is thus that I must avenge myself today. My rage is extinguished when I approach him. The more I see of him, the more my vengeance is ineffectual. My trembling arm denies my hate. Oh, what cruelty to rob him of the light of day. To this young hero, everything on earth surrenders. Who would believe that he was born only for war? He seems to be made for love. Oh, my goodness, she's changing her mind really fast now, is she not? I would continue. Could I not avenge myself unless he dies? Oh, is it not enough that love should punish him? Since he could not find my eyes charming enough, let him love me at least through my sorcery, so that, if it's possible, I may hate him. So at first she's going to kill him, and then she figures, all right, I'll make him fall in love with me, and then I'll hate him, and so he'll suffer through love. Yes, I myself would rather suffer through love than have my bosom pierced too. Now, I would point out that we're going to hear an extremely flexible, unmetrical sort of recitative, much more melodious than contemporary Italian recitative. And then she begins her brief aria. Come, come, support my desires, demons. Transform yourselves into friendly zephyrs. She's casting the spell to make him fall in love with her. I give in to this conqueror. Pity overwhelms me. Conceal my weakness and my shame in the most remote desert. Fly, fly, lead us to the end of the universe. All right. This is the aria, clearly more song-like than the preceding recitative, but short, matter-of-fact, and frankly anticlimactic in comparison to Italian aria. Let us listen. I trust we hear how different this recitative is from Italian opera. It sounds more exciting, it's more substantial, and at the price of a less substantial aria. This French recitative is, to my ears, not unlike the recitative of Monteverdi we heard way back in lectures 5, 6, 7, and 8. That early Italian recitative, which had to be more substantial because aria didn't exist yet, is very much what we hear here, a more dramatic, a more flexible, a highly melodic brand of recitative, which is familiar to those of us who know French opera and familiar to all of us now, having heard that. Please, some conclusions. The dignified formal splendor of Lully's opera embody the glorious age of Louis XIV. In France itself, Lully established opera as an institution of the state. And this is unique. This happens nowhere else in operatic history. Opera is established as an institution of the state. Now, of course, this is both good and bad. The bad news is obvious. The characteristic splendor and magnificence of French opera, originally created to glorify Louis XIV and his reign, will sound empty and pompous once that triumphal age has passed. However, the good news is that there is a French operatic style at all, a style that will, one, keep France from being absorbed entirely into the Italian operatic sphere, and two, a style that will provide the foundation for future generations of French and French-based opera composers. Jean-Philippe Rameau, 1683-1764. Rameau was the foremost French musician of the 18th century. He was an important and influential musical theorist and a composer of instrumental music and operas and cantatas. And again, this is somewhat unusual in this age of opera specialists. Rameau was a notoriously solitary, argumentative, and unsociable person, and he was famous for this, of all the things to be famous for. He remained feisty to the very end. Apparently, he found the strength on his deathbed, my friends, to reproach the priest who was administering last rites on his bad singing. I hope on my deathbed I still have that kind of strength, too. In any case, we are going to listen to part of a Rameau opera, this Hippolyte et Arissi. It is Rameau's first opera. It is a piece that Rameau himself would not have called an opera. Please, opera is an Italian word. Rameau would have called this a tragedy lyrique. All right, a quick overview of the storyline behind the aria we will hear. Hippolyte has been falsely accused of raping his stepmother. He is being banished, and this aria reflects his unhappiness at the thought of his exile and impending separation from his beloved Arissi. Quick word before we listen, because I didn't mention this a moment ago. Rameau is the first significant composer of French opera after Lully, and he sees himself as the inheritor of a great and majestic tradition. So with that in mind, let us listen to these words and then the music. The aria, Act 4, Scene 1. Ah, faut-il? Ah, must I in a day lose all that I love, and the troubles I fear and the riches I lose all overwhelm my heart with extreme pain. Under the terrible cloud that darkens my days, what will become of my glory in the eyes of the world? Ah, must I in a day lose all that I love? My father is banishing me forever from these parts, so dear to Diane herself. I shall see no more the beautiful eyes which made me supremely happy. Okay, please, 4 points before we listen to this aria by Rameau. Compared to Italian opera composers, Rameau, like Lully and other French opera composers, displays much less contrast between recitative and aria. Two, this aria, like ones by Lully, is a mixture of aria-like refrain and recitative-like speaking. Point three, unlike Lully, Rameau's aria uses the full harmonic and instrumental resources of the High Baroque. And why not? Rameau is almost an exact contemporary of Johann Sebastian Bach, and by now there's a lot more stuff in the musical language available to him. Point four, like Lully, this music is filled with controlled, measured grandeur and magnificence. Rameau. I just want to put in my aesthetic two cents before we move on. Rameau is a composer rarely heard from. He predates those Gluck operas, which really are the beginning of our opera house repertoire. But he's a really good composer of first-rate music. French opera is, sadly, especially earlier French opera, rarely heard outside of France, even at our universities and old music community performance groups that do deal with older opera, for example. And this has to do with the French language and the so space-specific nature of French music. It's so tailored for the particular needs of the French aristocracy in this case that it's music that tends not to be appreciated at almost any level outside of its original milieu. But it's really good music, and Rameau is a composer worth seeking out. All right. Controversy. Despite the fact that Rameau's operas were rooted in tradition, they almost immediately raised a storm of controversy. And please, again, I must remind you, in these wonderful days of the 16th and 17th and 18th century, opera was cutting-edge intellectual stuff capable of raising passions and controversy, the likes of which today we save for economics, politics, and technological discussions. Anyway, the controversy was Rameau's music. The Parisian intelligentsia, in, of course, a perpetual state of crank, always spoiling for a fight, were divided on Rameau's operas. In the blue corner, Madame et Monsieur, wearing the old-style 17th-century blue trunks with the doily trim, were the conservatives, the Lullists. The Lullists found Rameau's music subversive to French tradition. They claimed it to be difficult, grotesque, forced, mechanical, thick, and unnatural. In a word of two syllables, they found it to be Baroque. In the red corner, the progressives, who felt that Rameau was the savior of French opera, which, according to the progressives, had become stultified, ossified, and paralyzed by adherence to the Lully tradition. Now, Rameau, for his part, objected to the entire debate. He wrote, and now I quote Rameau, that I sought to imitate Lully not as a servile copyist, but in taking, like him, nature herself, so beautiful and so simple, as a model, unquote. And what is nature herself? Nature is the natural declamation of the French language. Now, let's move on to a new stage of this debate. 20 years later, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the War of the Buffoons or the Comic Actors, which we've talked about before but now must talk about today. It's most ironic that in less than 20 years, the nature of the controversy over Rameau's music shifted a full 180 degrees. Now, in a previous lecture, we discussed the so-called War of the Buffoons, the War of the Comic Actors, that erupted in 1752. It was one of these pamphlet wars so common in France, specifically Paris, at this time. This particular Parisian intellectual imbroglio was occasioned by the presence in Paris of an Italian opera company, which for 2 years had enjoyed sensational success with its productions of Italian comic operas, Italian opera buffet. One of these Italian comic operas was Pergolese's La Serva Padrona. Now, on one side of the War of the Buffoons were the traditionalists, or the French faction. They felt themselves to be the preservers of traditional French opera, the royal and magnificent French operatic tradition as exemplified by Lully and Rameau. Now Rameau's being lumped together with tradition, because on the other side of the War of the Buffoons was the Italian opera buffa faction, who believed that comic Italian operas like Pergolese's La Serva Padrona represented the operatic ideal for the new anti-royal, anti-elitist spirit of the Enlightenment. The leader of this progressive Italian faction was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778. Writer, philosophe, a composer of sorts, alienated intellectual, beatnik, hippie, punk. All right, let's listen to one of these pieces by Rousseau, his opera, Le Duvin du Village. Among many things, Rousseau fancied himself a librettist and a composer. In 1752, during the War of the Buffoons, inspired by these Italian opera buffe, he wrote a little opera entitled Le Duvin du Village, The Village Soothsayer. Rousseau's little opera, consisting of a series of arias and recitatives, is but one step removed from the popular French opera comique, in which the music consisted almost entirely of popular songs. We're talking about musical theater, or what the French called vaudevilles, or vaudeville. Let's sample an aria and a recitative from Rousseau's The Village Soothsayer of 1752. This is very different sounding music than anything we've heard before, for reasons that will become clear in a moment. But first, I would read the aria followed by the recitative that we will hear. Colette sings, I have lost all my happiness. I have lost my servant. Colin forsakes me. Alas, he could have changed. I would rather stop dreaming about it, yet I dream about it incessantly. Snore. All right, this music, these words completely lack any literary pretense whatsoever. I've lost my happiness, I've lost my servant. Yes, and how's the dog, one would like to know. It's important that we point out that these are purposefully common-sounding words, direct, not terribly artful, and therefore no artifice whatsoever. The recitative, he loved me once, and this was my bad luck. But who, then, is she whom he prefers? She must be very charming. Imprudent shepherdess, do you not fear at all the misfortunes that I'm experiencing today? Colin could have changed. You may have your turn. What good does it do to dream about it incessantly? Nothing can cure my love, and everything increases my sorrow. I want to hate him. I must do it. Perhaps he loves me still. Why does he shun me incessantly? Why does Rousseau keep using the same words? He used to look for me once. The soothsayer of the canton makes his home here. He knows all. He will know the fate of my love. I see him, and I want this clarified today. All right. Again, these words are not meant to be fancy. This is meant to be direct and to the point. Claude Poliska writes this. Inspired by the new Italian melodic style, this aria, sung by the heroine Colette, is neatly phrased in groups of two measures, naively harmonized and simply accompanied. The main tune returns after a recitative, an interlude that is indebted to Italian recitative for its speech-like delivery, but succumbs to the French appetite for ornaments. Please, when we compare this simple, popular music to the stately, regal magnificence of Rameau's Hippolyte et Aricie, we'll understand the musical, operatic, and social extremes represented by the War of the Buffoons. Let us listen, please. Rousseau.
Tout autrefois. qu'elle est douce, elle qu'il me préfère. Elle est donc bien charmante, imprudente bergère. Ne crains-tu point l'amour que j'éprouve en ce jour? Rien ne peut guérir mon amour et tout augmente ma tristesse. J'ai perdu mon serviteur, j'ai perdu tout mon bonheur. Il me cherchait tant autour de moi. Le devin du canton fait ici sa demeure. Il sait tout, il saura le sort de mon amour. Je le vois et je veux m'éclaircir en ce jour.
Look, depending on your point of view, this music is either cute and revolutionary in its attempt to create a new kind of French opera based on the Italian opera buffa, or it's simply insipid and stupid. Thank goodness for us, a much better composer is about to come along onto the French scene and truly show how to reform traditional French opera in a way that keeps the best of the past but modernizes it and brings something of the new into it as well. And that reformer on his way is Christoph Philibald Gluck, when we return the reforms and French operas of Gluck. Thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 25, a lecture entitled German Opera Comes of Age. First, my friends, early German opera, a very quick history. German language opera, as an internationally recognized genre of opera, distinct then from the Italian and French operas we have studied, came into being in 1791. With the creation and production of Mozart's The Magic Flute. By comparison, Italian opera came into being in 1600 with Peri's Eurydice, perhaps even earlier with Peri's Daphne. So there's been at least 191 years from the creation of the first internationally recognized Italian opera to the first such German opera. A distinctly French opera came into being in 1669, at least a French operatic institution, the Royal Academy of Paris. That's 122 years before the Magic Flute. Well, the Germans really seem to be carrying up the tail end on this one, so we must ask ourselves the question, why so late? Why did it take so long for a distinctly German operatic school to evolve? As usual, the answer has to do with national spirit and language. First, national spirit. Despite the fact that Italian opera was a popular form of entertainment at German courts, the overblown and improbable nature of these operas simply did not resonate with the more serious and logical nature of the German artistic intellectual community. Now, indeed, this sounds like I'm stereotyping, and I am, but it's necessary that we do this. Look, let me extend this question and get provincial for a moment. Let's pretend that this is post-revolutionary United States.
1785. What sort of operas would composers in America be composing if they were composing operas in 1785? Would the overblown characters of Italian opera seria or the silly yet wonderful plots of Italian opera buffa appeal to the young nation of the United States? Would there be a community to watch these operas, to create these operas, to perform these operas? No, I would say not. At that time, America was nation building. It was a young, energized, mercantile nation beginning to push at its frontiers. The overblown character of Italian opera seria, the silly and entertaining character of Italian opera buffa, had nothing in common with the spirit of America in 1785. So while some people in 1785 in Philadelphia or New York might have chosen to consume Italian opera as entertainment, the huge edifice and structures you need to create, perform, and sustain opera as a tradition would not have existed then, at least not have existed for the arcanity of Italian opera seria and buffa. So national spirit does have a lot to do with the kind of operas someone writes in a country. Now, I said the other reason why German language opera evolved late had to do with language. And this is a very important point that I'm going to spend a couple of minutes here. Look, 17th and 18th century Italian opera was dominated by singers. We've talked about that, by singers. Italian operatic singing style, by definition, requires huge, fat, endless vowels, with which we need to develop tone, expression, and virtuoso coloratura. Italian singing is in the vowels. That's where everything takes place, my friends. We need just enough consonants to clearly articulate and separate the vowels. This is singing as it evolved in Italy, and this is opera singing as it evolved in Italy, and Italian opera singing is the standard. Now, the Italian language, with its perfect balance of vowel and consonant, could not have been better designed if we had tried a million times over ourselves. Let's just take one Italian word, the word for Italian. Italiano. Now, let's just play with that word a little bit, shall we? It's got four wonderful vowels. Italiano. Italiano, Italiano, Italiano. Oh my goodness, we could play with that any way we like. The consonants are clean enough to clearly separate these four vowels from each other, but they don't get in the way. They're not harsh and they're not brutal. We could sustain any one of those vowels or all of those vowels as long as we wanted by a device called melisma. Melisma is when we attach many different pitches to a single syllable. Italiano. That was a melisma. Not a pretty one, but a melisma nevertheless. The point is, opera singing, by definition, is Italian singing. And Italian singing, by definition, is melisma, is coloratura, is beautiful, long, juicy vowels, cleanly and clearly separated by elegant consonants. Now, let's compare this briefly to French. How would we say French? Well, let's say français. Now, this is a whole different story, my friends. Français. The consonants are not sharp and clear. They kind of blur into the vowels themselves, as does so much of the French language. It is a blurred and wonderfully colored language, but it is not one of sharp and clean articulation. Now, composers of French opera had to deal with this difference of the French language from the Italian language right away. Francais. It's not a language given to long melisma, not like Italian. The vowels are there, but if we go on too long on a vowel in French, we're going to lose the meaning of the word because the consonants aren't clear enough to rescue the vowels, frankly. It's true. So as Italian aria evolves, we've talked about this, Italian arias have much less coloratura than Italian arias, and French arias have much less coloratura than Italian arias. And additionally, French recitative is a little more melodic than Italian recitative, because when you're kind of talking in French, then you can doctor it up a little more. The reason why French singing style in French opera evolves differently from Italian has to do with the nature of the language. And until French composers, or at least Jean-Baptiste Lully, an Italian-born composer who showed the French how to use their own language properly, until French composers adapted their composing style to the realities of their language, French opera would only be a mimic, a mirror, a poor one at that of Italian singing style and Italian opera. So French opera comes into its own as soon as a proper French declamatory style is achieved, and that's achieved by Lully. Now back to where we are today, apropos of German opera. Look, say what you like about the French language, but it's still a Romance language, that is a Roman-based language, and it shares much in common with Italian. Italiano. Francais. Deutsch! Now that, my friends, is a whole new ball game. Deutsch! Where, oh where, do we put melisma in German? Oh, I don't know. Deutsch! Oh, no. This is a language dominated by consonants, dominated by articulation, dominated by attack, a spiky language of understated vowel and overwhelming consonants. It is not a language given to melisma. How are we going to do traditional Italian singing style filled with coloratura, filled with melisma in the German language? We're not. We could try to force that Italian singing style onto the German language, and that's what was done during the 1600s and 1700s. But that's not German opera. That's just Italian opera being sung poorly in German. We've all had the experience, by the way, I trust we've all had the experience, because we should have it once, of hearing an Italian opera sung in English. And it sounds stupid, aside from the fact that we actually understand the words, and it comes as a shock sometimes to hear how dumb these words really are. We also hear a language not suited to the melisma that was properly written for a very different sort of language. English is a Germanic language, and of course, German, filled with consonants and short vowels, cannot be used in an Italian style. I mention all of this because true German opera, in terms of both singing style and the nature of its plots, will have to evolve from native German roots and not by imitating and adapting Italian opera as the French essentially did in creating a French national opera. Please, German singing style demands what we call a syllabic setting, that is, one pitch per syllable, one syllable per pitch, as opposed to the melismatic settings of Italian opera. Do you remember, by the way, when we talked about the War of the Buffoons and Rousseau made that statement that the French language was not suited to opera singing? This is all he was talking about. And of course, it wasn't really true. The French language can be adapted to opera singing, but what he was saying is that the French language was not Italian, and that's true. No language is Italian. But my friends, if the French language is not Italian, then the German language is Martian. And again, until a specific kind of singing style based on the nature of the German language can evolve, one that is syllabic in its setting, we're not going to have a true German operatic tradition. And so German opera will not evolve from Italian opera or from French opera. German opera is going to have to evolve from native German roots that already accept the nature of the German language. Which brings us to Singspiel, Singspiel, literally sing play or a play with singing. This is a German play with music. Singspiel is a very general word. In the 17th century, this word was applied to virtually any stage work that included music, vocal music, from song and dance troupes to Italian opera. Singspiel, as we understand the word properly today, is a partly sung, partly spoken German theatrical genre that had its roots in popular culture. Very important statement. I'm going to say it again. Singspiel, as we understand the word today, is a partly sung, partly spoken German theatrical genre that had its roots in popular German culture. Now, in England, such a partly sung,
partly spoken theatrical work would be called a ballad opera or an operetta. In France, such a work would be part of the tradition of opera comique. In the United States, we would call such a work a musical or a musical show. There is no equivalent in Italian musical theater, as all Italian works, light or heavy, serious or comic, are sung in their entirety. So the Italian tradition is a completely sung one, and almost every other national tradition includes some degree of spoken dialogue. Mozart's Singspiel, The Rescue from the Harem of 1782, Die Entführung aus dem Serail, is a romantic comic adventure and rescue story. So it's one of these Singspiels, and it's meant to be a popular entertainment. Though the subject had been treated many times by many different composers and librettists, according to historian Claude Poliska, Mozart in one stroke raised the German Singspiel into the realm of great art without altering any of its established features. So in 1782, with his piece The Rescue from the Harem, Mozart takes a popular and common entertainment and elevates it because of his extraordinary talent. And it is Mozart's use of Singspiel that will put German opera on the map. Again, a genre that evolves from common German roots, heightened and elevated by a great composer, becomes an internationally recognized operatic form. And of course, it is the Magic Flute, which was also a Singspiel of 1791, that puts German opera on the international map. It's the last major work that Mozart completed. Its first performance was September 30th of 1791. Mozart would be dead in less than 3 months. It was commissioned by librettist, director, actor Emanuel Schikaneder, who also wrote the libretto, or a good portion of the libretto. Schikaneder took credit for writing the libretto of Magic Flute, but history has proven him a bit conceited in this one. Others had a hand in it. Indeed, Mozart probably also had a major hand in preparing this libretto, but we give Schikaneder credit as librettist nevertheless. He was also the first Papageno in the opening production. Now, this piece was commissioned for performance, the Magic Flute was, at a Burgtheater, that is, at a music hall, as opposed to the Hofstheater, the Imperial Opera House, where The Marriage of Figaro was produced. So the Burgtheater meant that this was meant, the Magic Flute, for middle and lower middle class entertainment, as popular entertainment. Again, Mozart, through his incredible talent and art, elevates a popular form to a level theretofore unimagined. He's working within a German tradition, but the tradition becomes operatic in its substance due to his talent. All right, the plot of The Magic Flute, which is that first internationally recognized German opera, and that's why we start German opera with The Magic Flute. The plot is half fairy tale and half morality play. First, the fairy tale part. The Magic Flute is filled with strange, exotic, and supernatural people, beings, and animals. The action takes place in an ancient Egyptian fantasy world. My kids loved and still love The Magic Flute because of the dancing animals and the strange scenes and the weird costumes and wonderful creatures. So it's got an exotic fairy tale element to it. But it also is a subtle and profound morality play. It's about Masonic initiation ritual and Enlightenment ideals. Schikaneder and Mozart were Masonic brothers, and they both believed, as so many Enlightenment people did, in the message of brotherhood and Masonry. And so The Magic Flute is about Masonic initiation rites, and it's filled with Masonic symbolism and devices. Now, we would need days and days to go through these, so I won't. Let's just talk about the music, and we'll listen to one of the numbers. The music is brilliant. It's Mozart. We could expect nothing else. And much of it is quite popular in that it is meant for a popular audience. It's popular as befits a Burgtheater Singspiel. For example, the entrance aria for Papageno, The Birdcatcher. All right, the action up to this point, please. Tamino, a stranger in this strange land, is being pursued by a huge, and we assume, a hungry serpent. And this is how the Singspiel begins. Some strange, weird concoction, probably people inside a costume that looks like a snake, running after this poor guy dressed as a Japanese in the middle of this Egyptian scene. Strange, wonderful, and bizarre. All right, what does our hero do at this moment? He faints out of fear. Very macho. Indeed, Tamino's learning to be a man is a lot of what this opera is about. Then three mysterious ladies appear out of nowhere, and together they slay the snake. Yes, all sorts of Freudian imagery comes to mind here. We'll keep that out for now as well. And then, having admired the unconscious Tamino, this wonderful stud, they exit. Tamino awakens, frankly surprised to be alive. And then he speaks the following dialogue. Regaining consciousness, looks around, frightened. Where am I? Is it a fantasy that I'm still alive? He rises and looks around. That awful snake dead at my feet? The sound of panpipes is heard in the distance. What do I hear? He withdraws and observes. Papageno, dressed in a suit of feathers, hurries by, carrying a large birdcage on his back and a panpipe in his hands. We hear a longish introduction, which allows Papageno time to make his entrance. Prominent is the panpipe motive he plays to attract birds. When he reaches the center of the stage, he begins to tell us about himself in a number that has the easygoing gait of popular Viennese music. This melody quickly attained folk song status. I am a man of widespread fame, and Papageno is my name. To tell you all in simple words, I make my living catching birds. The moment they attract my eye, I spread my net, and in they fly. I whistle on my pipe of pan. In short, I am a happy man. He whistles and then removes the cage from his back. Second verse, essentially the same as the first. Although I am a happy man, I also have a future plan. I dearly love my feathered friends, but that's not where my interest ends. To tell the truth, I'd like to find a pretty girl of my own kind. In fact, I'd like to fill my net with all the pretty girls I met. Third verse, same as the first. Essentially the same, none the worst. Once all the girls were in my net, I'd keep the fairest for my pet, my sweetheart and my bride-to-be, to love and cherish tenderly. I'd bring her cake and sugar plums and be content to eat the crumbs. She'd share my little nest with me. A happier pair could never be. He whistles and turns to leave. Simple, absolutely straightforward form. It's what we call a strophic song. The same music three times, each time to different words. Folkish, direct melody of indescribable charm and grace. And then more spoken dialogue. Tamino steps out from his hiding spot and says, Hey there! Papageno is taken aback. Who's there? Tamino, tell me who you are, my jolly friend. And Papageno says, Who I am? Well, silly question. A man like you. Let's listen to this, and here's what I want you to be aware of while we listen. I want you to notice the folk-like directness of this tune and its simple phrase structure. A prime, A double prime. The same music three times. I want you to note how it well defines the rustic Papageno. Such music, point three, will have a direct effect on a popular audience. They're going to get it right away. Please note the syllabic setting. Is this an aria or a song? Well, it's Mozart, so we call it an aria. But frankly, there's a syllable for every pitch, a pitch for every syllable. This is pure German-style singing. No melisma here. And also, please note the spoken dialogue. There is no secco recitative.
Wo bin ich? Ist's Fantasie? Dass ich noch lebe? Die Schlange? Tot? Was höre ich?
Some quick conclusions, please. A distinctly German language, internationally recognized opera tradition develops late in the 18th century. This operatic tradition grows out of the popular tradition of Singspiel. The melodies are well fitted to the characteristics of the German language, and spoken dialogue is heard in place of secco recitative. By the way, I have to make a point here. Recitative is not part of the German tradition. However, if we listen to the cantatas and masses of Bach, let's say, written 50 years before the Magic Flute, we hear lots of recitative. I want to make a point. Even though Bach is working in German, he's using aspects of the Italian style. And that Italian style will not last in German music into the 19th century and even beyond. Rather, 19th century German opera, which becomes so important and so influential and so essential to the modern repertoire, will develop from Singspiel. It will not develop from Germanic imitations of Italian operatic style like Bach's incredible cantatas and masses. So Bach's cantatas and masses, for example, represent an evolutionary dead end in terms of the large-scale development of German opera. That's not to say they're not magnificent. They are. They're among the best pieces of music ever written, anytime, any place, anybody. But in terms of evolution, they represent themselves a dead end. It is Singspiel, with its spoken dialogue and syllabic settings of the German language, which will become the basis for the international German tradition. I would also point out that plots and storylines of these Singspiels are generally drawn from German folk stories and folk imagery that show a distinct preference for supernatural characters and situations. So, out of this grows 19th century German opera, which becomes an experimental, cutting-edge operatic tradition. The reason there is so much experimentation in 19th century German opera, unlike opera in Italy and France, there is no long-standing operatic tradition, and there's no operatic industry, which needs to be fed tremendous amounts of money. Look, everything operatic in Germany is pretty much new in the early 19th century, so romantic trends flourish. Experimentation flourishes in the context of German opera in the 19th century. Now, quickly, a quick couple of words, because many of you are probably thinking, he's skipping Fidelio? He's skipping Beethoven? Yes, I'm skipping Fidelio. Fidelio was written in 1805 and was revamped for reperformance in 1814. Why am I skipping Beethoven? Because this is an Italian-style opera written on a French subject. I'm also skipping Italian-language opera. We're not hearing any